Let's get out to the Band of Brothers hotline, talk some West Coast Conference hoops. Let's talk Gonzaga. Let's talk BYU. Mike Rutherford from SB Nation. Mike, how you living?
Not bad. How are you guys doing?
We're doing fantastic. Glad to have you on. I know it's a long ways away. We all know this, but it is the summer months. We are in the midst of it, and we want to talk about previews. We want to talk about some Gonzaga, some BYU. You've put Gonzaga as number one, the front runner, as they always are in the West Coast Conference, and then BYU second to them. What did you think of this last year's season in the West Coast Conference? Let's start it off with that. Were you surprised that Gonzaga stayed as dominant as they were? Were you surprised that BYU was able to knock them off at Gonzaga?
Well, I was definitely surprised that BYU was able to win there just because it's such a tough place to play. At the same time, you know, BYU obviously needed that game way more than Gonzaga did, and I certainly was not surprised that Gonzaga was able to stay on top. And I kind of hate the fact that the whole narrative surrounding the WCC has become, you know, Gonzaga and whether or not they deserve to be a top two seed or whether or not they deserve to be a top five nationally ranked team. Because, look, the WCC is not the Patriot League. It's not the MAAC. It's a decent league, and they're probably playing better now as an entire conference than they ever have been, but that fact is totally overshadowed because Gonzaga is so good, and because of the whole debate, you know, people, general college basketball fans don't want to believe that Gonzaga is, you know, a top three national seed, and so they use whatever ammo they have against them, and in this case, the ammo against Gonzaga is what conference they play in, and it's not really fair to the rest of the league. That said, you know, the teams behind Gonzaga, especially that top two of St. Mary's and BYU, kind of need to step it up because BYU goes to the first four again and they kind of blow a lead in historic fashion to Ole Miss. St. Mary's is one and done in the NIT. The only other team to get a postseason invite is Pepperdine, which is embarrassed by Seattle in the CBI, I guess. And so you have no postseason wins in that league besides Gonzaga. So if the West Coast Conference wants to be known as a league other than just, you know, the conference that Gonzaga plays in, the rest of the league has to step up, and that has to start this year, I think.
Totally agreed. And, you know, looking at the talent level coming back at BYU, obviously you lost Tyler Hawes. Hopefully Tyler makes it into the NBA. If not, I'm sure he'll have a great professional career overseas, wherever he chooses. But what do you think about the talent coming back for BYU? How competitive will they be? Do you think that, you know, if they end up second to Gonzaga in the West Coast Conference, they can finally get over that hump with the talent that they have next year?
Well, I think so. They're as intriguing a team as there is in the league next year because, you know, you don't know how good these newcomers are and you know who you have coming back, but you also don't know how much Tyler Hall, the school's all-time leading scorer, is going to be. You still have Chase Fisher, who can light it from the outside. You still have Kyle Collinsworth, Mr. Triple-Double. And then you have, you know, transfers from Utah State and UNLV who figure to play a pretty heavy role in that team. I think that there's the potential for BYU to be even better than they were a year ago. But, you know, they've got to become more consistent. It was a team last year that I really think, you know, could basically compete with anybody. They could definitely score with anybody, but they never really could put complete games together. And that game against Ole Miss and Dayton in the first four was sort of a microcosm of their entire season. And really a microcosm of the last, you know, 3 or 4 years. It feels like they're always being bandied about as one of those teams that might wind up in the first four. For, you know, to be perfectly honest, they should be better. They've got more talent than their results would indicate. And I think this next year is going to be a pretty good indication of whether or not you can expect more from them because they should be good again. And really, they should beat the teams in the West Coast Conference outside of Gonzaga. And I think that it's a really, really interesting and really big year for BYU coming forward because I think when they made the move to the West Coast Conference, a lot of people expected them to kind of be on Gonzaga's level and to challenge them for regular season and conference tournament titles. And the fact that they haven't really done that yet is sort of surprising. Look, Gonzaga has won 14 of the last 15 regular season titles in that league, and that was kind of a run that people expected BYU to compete with them for. And if that doesn't start next year, then at some point, you have to start asking questions about when it is going to start or if it's going to start. So I think this 2015-16 season is a really, really big one for BYU, not just for the season itself, but for the whole program going forward.
You know, we're always talking about, like, tournament runs, right? Because that's what really matters here. And we're talking about other teams in the West Coast Conference finally making some sort of a run, making a dent in the NCAA tournament. I've been told from a couple different people that in order to get to the tournament, it seems like you can get there without an NBA player. But in order to win in the tournament, you got to have at least one guy that is an NBA caliber basketball player. In order to make a run, you need 2 to 3 stars on that team and that are of that NBA caliber. And I see that with Gonzaga. How many NBA caliber guys are on Gonzaga this next year?
Well, I mean, I think at least 2. I think Kyle Collinsworth's there. And I think
no, I'm talking about Gonzaga.
Gonzaga. Well, BYU's definitely got one in Kyle Collinsworth. I think Gonzaga has a couple. I think that both of their big guys can definitely play. Karnowski and Arbidas' boy, Sabonis, can definitely play in the NBA. I think Kyle Wiltshire has a chance. I think that he probably won't be drafted very high next year, and that's why he didn't leave this year. But he's kind of, you know, his skill set is so, I guess, different from anybody else in college basketball that it's hard to say he won't get a shot. When you look at the NBA and how many times you've had big guys who can shoot threes just kind of hanging around the league for a long time, you think of Steve Novak. You think of the Fitzpatrick kid from Marquette, too. Guys that are just kind of, you know, they have a niche. The NBA is a league made up of like 19 or 20 stars and then a bunch of guys who fill a niche, who can do one thing better than most people in the world. And if Kyle Wiltshire can prove that, hey, I'm a 6'10 guy who can stroke threes and get my shot off with regularity, I think he can play in the NBA. That said, you know, if he was that good and that much of a lock, he probably would have left after this year because he was a leading scorer on a team that, you know, was one win away from the Final Four. But I would say that there are at least 3 players on that team right now with the capability to play in the NBA.
You know, hey, how you doing? It's JT. I'm 100% more of a comment on everything you're saying, not even a question. You nailed everything you said. When we moved to the West Coast Conference, I thought that we're able to stay up with Gonzaga a little bit more. But something that Ben said that I'm just going to go disagree a little bit is about, you know, needing NBA type of guys. I wouldn't say, as you know, NBA type of guys as much as pro guys. I'm really good friends with JP Batista that played there and kind of like where Gonzaga started pretty much the international flavor, but making sure Gonzaga had pro guys. And you nailed right on the head when you're talking about Kyle and Sabonis kids. The difference between Gonzaga and pretty much every other school in the WCC is just the amount of pro guys you have on a team. You know, I look back to my years at BYU when we just pretty much ran the Mountain West. We had about 4 or 5 guys that went pro at one time on the team, you know, and we had about 4 guys on the court at the same time that, you know, are playing pro right now. So I think you hit, you know, I just pretty much just making a comment right here and just, you know, agreeing with you that you hit the nail right in the head where you just need pro guys. And right now Gonzaga has more than pretty much, you know, a lot of the other schools, even throughout the country, where they have 3, 4, 5 guys, and especially with, you know, Europeans coming that have played somewhat in professional teams or in professional clubs and they've experienced that, and they'll most likely go back there. So, you know, I agree 100% of everything you've said so far.
Mike Rutherford from SB Nation on with us here, Cougar Sports, ESPN 960. Mike, speaking on that pro-level player, it seems like Gonzaga is always getting transfers that are pro-level players. What transfers have come in this offseason that we need to know about?
Well, you know, it's not just Gonzaga. It's really everybody who's getting transfers. With the whole fifth-year deal, you know, a lot of people say it's killing mid-major basketball, and the West Coast Conference is definitely a mid-major league. But still, the top-tier programs in the league have benefited as much as anybody from big-time transfers. You look at Byron Wesley from the USC kid who came in and definitely played a huge role in what Gonzaga was able to do right there. Gonzaga also losing a transfer this season in Angel Nunez, who's going to South Florida. I think the whole argument about fifth-year transfers is kind of ridiculous to me because, look, it's eligible. Any sport can do it in major college athletics. It's not limited to just basketball. And if we're going to act like, you know, these kids are here for an education, then why not take the act fully into graduate transfers? When these kids are supposed to have earned their degree. They're supposed to be working on graduate degrees. Why punish a kid who's going to earn an undergraduate degree in any capacity? So the whole fifth-year transfer argument, I don't really buy it. There aren't a whole lot of big-time impact transfers in the WCC this upcoming season outside of BYU, who I think is definitely going to be affected by both the Utah State and UNLV transfers. But in all, I think the fifth-year transfer is probably a better rule for college basketball than most sports, just because kids are getting their degrees. And if you want to at least put up the front that this is about student-athletes, then the rule is a good one because you're forcing kids to get their degrees if they want to keep playing.
I think the biggest question for all BYU fans is how can they compete with Gonzaga, with how many just great players, great coaching, how consistent they are. They work their tails off. BYU is traditionally known as a kind of grinded out, very disciplined team that it can score the rock. And Gonzaga does that. They match that effort on the floor. But something that BYU lacked this year is a big man presence, a healthy big man. In order for BYU to compete, they have to find somebody. Right now they're targeting Willie Cuasi. They were targeting the kid out of Liberty. Do you see anybody? I don't know how much you follow recruiting, but are there any fifth-year transfers outside of the you know, Willie Cuasi, who we just found out about a few days ago, that BYU can pick up, whether it's a JC transfer or a fifth-year transfer that you know of?
You know, there are bodies out there right now, but for the most part, the big-time impact transfers are all accounted for. But no, you're 100% right when you say that the biggest difference between BYU and Gonzaga, at least right now in this past couple of seasons, has been on the inside, because BYU can score with anybody. They have been able to score with anybody for the last 3 years, but they don't have the bodies inside that Gonzaga has, and they haven't really since, you know, Kelly Olynyk was there. And that's the biggest thing that sets Gonzaga apart from the rest of the conference, that wasn't always the case with that program. They're well-rounded now. You know, there have been years where they've had really good guards. There have been years where they've had really good inside players. And this past season, and I think this upcoming season as well, they have both. And BYU really doesn't have that right now, especially when you have a two-headed monster inside like Karnowski and Sabonis with Gonzaga. You've got to get bodies. And I think BYU, it doesn't have to be the most talented guy in the world. You've got to get a big frame who can get rebounds and who can defend, and most importantly, perhaps, has five fouls to give, because you've got to have guys out there who can defend without fear. So I think that BYU definitely needs to bring in a fifth-year transfer or a big-time recruit on the inside. And I'm not sure who's out there for them. I don't think it's a big enough name. There's not really a big game changer. But if nothing less, they need a big body to take up space on the inside so they can at least have a chance to compete in the paint. You don't want to get killed on the inside. You don't want a guy going off for, you know, you don't want two centers combining for 35 and 15 or something like that, because that really gives you no chance regardless of how effective you are on the offensive end of the court. So, yeah, I completely agree with you. That needs to be their main target right now when it comes to recruiting.
Mike, what did you think of Corbin Cafusi and his development this year? He, turned off a mission, never played even AAU ball, stepped in by the midseason. He looked pretty good in that finale versus Gonzaga, blocked some shots, looked athletic running up down the floor. What type of impact do you think he can have versus these two big men in Sabonis and Karnowski?
The Mission kids at BYU are always fascinating to me, because it takes me so long to remember that they left and that they came back. You know, I think of Eric Micah, who was such a good force inside, and who was just, I feel like, was just kind of becoming a star at the college level, and then he's gone. You know, it's got to be, coaching at BYU has to be the hardest job in the world, because you feel like you're developing players, and then suddenly you know they're gone, and they come back, and you kind of don't even know who they are. So as far as guys coming back into the fold and all that good stuff, I don't know how anybody just lasts at BYU. It's such an odd job, and I don't envy whoever has to develop the players and whoever has to, you know, lose them for a couple of years and just kind of hope that they're still honing their skills. So, you know, the big man transition, they need all the bodies they can get again. I don't know how much anybody can help, but it's going to be an interesting year, and I still think that BYU, talent-wise, is the second-best team in the WCC, and if they don't finish there, then, you know, it's nobody's fault but their own.
You mentioned that Pepperdine is poised to break out. Tell me why.
Well, they get so many people back from last season, and, you know, they were really rolling. They started off 8-4 in the WCC last year before their point guard, Amadi Udenye, got hurt. He should be back next year. As should most of the, I think the top seven scorers from that team are all planning on being back. The question mark there is how well they can score. They were the best defensive team statistically in the WCC last year, and I think the second worst offensive team. So there's a good that comes with getting all those guys back, but there's also a bad, because you don't have anybody coming in who can light it up from the outside, and you know you need that facet of your offense to really compete. So either these guys are going to get a lot better at shooting, they're going to get a lot better at developing their outside shots, or Pepperdine's not going to make that next jump to the level where they're, you know, competing for a top two spot in the WCC and competing for an NCAA tournament bid. I think that they still, you know, when you have that many guys back, they won 18 games last year, they made a postseason tournament. That kind of experience really, really helps you. And I think that, look, if Marty Wilson's going to get it done at Pepperdine, it's going to be this year. So I feel like they're going to put all their chips into this season. And if it doesn't happen then it might not happen ever. So it's a big year for them, and I think they have the experience and the talent to really be a top three team, at least, in the WCC this year.
Mike Rutherford from SB Nation on with us here, Cougar Sports, ESPN 960. The NCAA announced the news today that Division I men's basketball teams will play with a 30-second shot clock, a 4-foot restricted area arc, and with 4 timeouts instead of 5. How will this affect the college basketball game played within the West Coast Conference? Do you see any direct effects, immediate effects on any particular team? How will it affect the season in these individual teams?
Well, I think there will definitely be effect, but I think it's going to be a minimal effect. When you look at the stats, you know, they used the 30-second shot clock in all the postseason tournaments besides the NCAA tournament last year, and it was kind of what you would expect. You know, shooting percentages were down because players were having to take shots quicker. Possessions were up, and scoring overall was up, but a minimal amount. It was about a point per game, or a point per team, I should say, in those 3 postseason tournaments. So I think it actually, the weird thing is the 30-second shot clock actually helps defensive teams a little bit more. Teams that will press and trap at half court and make opponents use, you know, 12, 13 seconds before they can really get into their offense. You know, a team like Virginia, everyone will say, you know, the 30-second shot clock will hurt them, but it's actually really going to help them because they put a lot of pressure on the ball up top. And if you can, you know, you don't need to force turnovers with your press. You don't need to force turnovers with your half court trap. You just slow teams down and keep them out of their offense early in the shot clock. And if teams are starting their shot, their possessions with 17, 18 seconds left on the shot clock, it kind of screws things up for you. So I think that will be a big effect. I think the bigger effect when it comes to scoring is the wider lane, like you talked about, because the problem with scoring in college basketball isn't really precipitated by the shot clock. It's precipitated by the lack of space. You need more spacing because I think college basketball does have better talent than the scores and stats would give it credit for. They just needed the ability to sort of move and let their offensive skills show. And a bigger lane, and if they did move the 3-point line back, which is another change I think should happen, it would create more space for those guys to work. So I think those two things, in addition to a heightened emphasis on avoiding hand checking and, you know, kind of the physical play on defense, those are the best changes that could possibly happen for college basketball. But, you know, the shot clock is such a huge rule change just because everybody knows the rule. It's like, you know, if they move the first down yardage in football from 10 yards to 11 yards, it would be a huge deal just because everybody knows the rule. So I think it's not as big as maybe the impact is, you know, perceived to be nationally, but still, it's a baby step in the right direction. And this is how you fix college basketball scoring issues, by chipping away. There's no one gigantic fix. So I like the rule changes. I'm glad they happened, and I'm glad it became official today.
I agree with you, especially about the 30-second shot clock. I think that, you know, going from 35 to 30 is not that big of a deal. If it were to go from 35 to 24, that would be huge. You know, we're talking a little bit about BYU here, so especially because we already play fast-paced. What about, how do you feel about maybe expanding the NCAA tournament a little bit? Instead of going, you know, the first four, maybe going to the first 8, you know, I don't see how this would be a negative. You know, I think that the NCAA tournament gets so much publicity. It's such a cool event, you know. Why not go to 72 and then just have, you know, one more round of the first 4 out and make it, you know, a 2-day deal? How would you feel about that?
Well, I think the biggest argument against it is you don't mess with a good thing. And the NCAA tournament right now is probably, you know, I don't want to say it's the most popular postseason in American sports, but it's widely perceived to be the best. And I think it's for a reason. I wish it was still at 64, to be perfectly honest. I think that was the perfect number. I think the first 4 kind of messes with things. It sort of feels like it's, you know, it's just an outlier that shouldn't be there. But, you know, the more games, the more money, the more TV contracts. I get that. And I like the fact that it didn't expand more, because that was a big rumor, and everyone complains about the Final Four being on TNT or TBS. And the fact of the matter is that TV contract is what saved the NCAA tournament from expanding to, you know, basically double to where it was almost a 100-plus team tournament, which I think would have just been terrible. Because, look, everyone likes to rag on college basketball's regular season, but the fact of the matter is it's more important than people give it credit for. Yeah, you can lose 12 games and still get a decent seed and maybe make a run in the Big Dance, but you position yourself. It's really hard to win that tournament without a top three national seed. It's not impossible, certainly. We've seen it happen in recent years, but it's a lot harder, and I think that's why the regular season is important. And if you expand the tournament to 120, so it just devalues it that much more. And I would hate to see that happen. If it moved to 72, you know, on the surface, it's not that bad of a move. You know, you feel like you're not changing that much. But it's a slippery slope, because it definitely opens up the door for that bigger expansion, which I do think would hurt the game significantly to happen. So I'd like to see it stay where it is. I'd actually like to see it go back to 64, but, you know, beggars can't be choosers here. So if it stays at 68, I'm more than happy with that.
What about if we were to do something, and I'm just asking you this because it's something that, you know, playing overseas, you always talk to teammates and, you know, listening and kind of reading, you know, the talk heads on ESPN and CBS and that kind of stuff. How would you feel personally about maybe eliminating the NIT or even the CBI and just do one tournament, you know, just one kind of a one postseason? You know, I know you're kind of a purist talking about the 64 team, but, you know, and you're talking about TV and talking about attention. I personally think it would be cool instead of just doing a 72 or 76, 76 team like they were, you know, thinking about, like you mentioned, but even maybe just a one tournament for all, you know, all schools and, you know, where, you know, like you said, you're kind of against, but about kind of getting rid of the NIT and getting rid of the CBI and just making the NCAA tournament. How would you tweak that? How would you do it? You know, if even if you're against it, how would you do it?
Oh, I mean, I'm 100% in favor of eliminating all postseason tournaments besides the NCAA tournament. I mean, you know, CBI, I should say, CIT. I'm not going to lie to you. I'll be perfectly honest. I cover college basketball. I can't remember who won those tournaments. I don't know if you all can, but I have no idea. And it's because I don't care. You know, I don't watch. I'll watch the NIT because there aren't other games happening, and, you know, the programs are usually decent, but would I be crushed if the NIT was gone forever? Absolutely not. The NCAA tournament is all that matters in college basketball. And the NIT, I mean, you know, the whole only reason it exists is because the whole argument of would you rather win the NIT or be a first-round exit in the NCAA tournament. And I think most programs and most fan bases would agree. It's you'd rather be one and done in the Big Dance. The Big Dance is Amen. The show in college basketball, and there are no other sports which have this kind of phenomenon with a lower-tier tournament in the postseason that basically means nothing. So to answer your question, I have no problem doing away with those three tournaments.
Mike, we appreciate you hopping on with us. Great insight. I think our BYU fans liked the preview, and I hope you see more traffic coming to your website and all of your articles from our show. Mike, let's do it again soon, brother.
Absolutely, guys. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, thank you.